Philo Torah Zoom Shiur for Yom Sheni, Monday, the 7th day of Tammuz, 5786, corresponding this year to June 22nd. Always does this. Tehillim Kuf, Mizmor LeTodah, Hariu LaAdonai Kol HaOretz, Ivdu Et Adonai B'Simcha, Bo'u LeFanav B'Yirnana. Te'u Ki Adonai Hu Elohim, Hu Asanu, V'Lo Anachnu, Amo V'Tzon Marito. Bo'u Sha'arav B'Todah, Chatzerotav B'Tehillah, Hodu Lo Baruchu Shemo, Ki Tov Adonai Le'olam Chasto, V'Ador V'Ador Emunato. Tehillim Kaf, David.
Lamanaseach Mizmor David, Yan Charna Biyom Tzara Yisagevcha, Shem Elohe Yaakov, Yishlach Ezrecha Mikodesh, Mitzion, Yisadecha, Yizkor Kol Menchasecha, V'Yolasecha, Yidash Nesela, Yiten Lecha Kivovecha, V'Chol Atzasecha, Yimale, Ein Ramana Nebishua Secha, U'Veshem Eloheinu Nigo, Yimale Adonai, Kol Mishalosecha, Ata yadati ki Yashia Adonai Mashiach Yaneu Mishmei Kodesho Bigvuros Yesha Yimino Elev Arecha Ve'elev Asusim Vanachnu B'Shem Adonai Eloheinu Nazkir Hei Malkaru V'Nafalu Vanachnu Kamnu V'Nesodod Adonai Hoshia Hamelech Yaneinu B'Yom Kareinu.
Kuf Lamed Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Krati'cha Adonai Adonai Shema v'koli tehiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai mi ya'amod. Ki mecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, kim Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Mark.
Mitzvah Berachah Avosenu Abraham Yitzchak Yaakov, V'yavorech es chayalei tzeva hagana li'Yisrael, v'esanshei kohos habitachon, ha'omedim al mishmar arkinu v'arei Elohinu, v'alofamim ba'adenu. Min halavanon va'abibar mitrenu min hayam hagadol adlo harava ufumakom tehem vayabasha ba'avir uvayam yitain adonai es hayavinu akamim aleinu nigavim lishnehem hakadosh baruch hu yishmor v'yatzil es chayalinu mikol tzara v'tzuka mikol nega machala v'yishlach barakha v'asacha b'chol ma'aseh yadehem yaber asoninu tachtehem v'yatarim b'chetra yishua u'v'ateres yitzachon v'yikuyam bahem hakatuv ki adonai eloheichem ha'alech imachem lehilachem lachem imo yevechem lehoshia eschem v'nomar amen.
Amen. Together, Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya, Ha'omedim Bein Bayam, Bein Bayabasha, Uvein Ba'avir, Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem, V'yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha, Umeafela Lo'ora Umishibud Legula, Hashta Ba'agala Uvizman Kariv, V'nomar Amen. Okay. This week in Israel, we read Parshat Balak. In Chutz La'aretz, they read Chukat Balak. Question. Do people in Chutz La'aretz combine Chukat and Balak to catch up to us? Or do we separate Chukat from Balak in order to slow down and get back in sync with Parshat HaShavua for all over the world?
The latter.
Get yourself an answer to the question.
The latter.
Actually, the former. Well, I forgot what I said already. What was the latter?
No, the first one you said, do we double up to catch up with you,
right,
with Eretz Yisrael,
okay.
or does Eretz Yisrael slow down?
Right.
To...
Okay, that was the latter. So the answer is, as much as we in Israel might not like to say it, The system of a one-year Torah reading dates back to the Tanaim, back in the 3rd century of the Common Era. A one-year cycle, including the rules of when you double up and when you separate sedras, in order to make the cycle from the Shabbos after Shmini Atzeret all the way around till Simchas Torah. In Israel at the time, the laning was done much shorter sedras in a 3.5 year cycle. And lest you think that we got away here in Israel with shorter sedras, it was accompanied by a Meturgeman who not only translated each pasuk into Aramaic, but probably gave little Divrei Torah here and there, so the laning stretched out. In any event, it was much later in the anywhere from the 7th to the 10th century that Israel adopted the Chutz La'aretz program of a one-year cycle. However, we had problems. We have only 7 days of Pesach, and the system was built for Chutz La'aretz from Bavel for Chutz La'aretz, which has 8 days Pesach. That means that there are some years where Pesach runs for us Shabbos to Friday, and the following day is a regular weekly reading. And Chutz La'aretz, they celebrate the 8th day of Pesach in those years on Shabbat. They have a special Torah reading for the 8th day of Pesach, and they don't get to Parshat HaShavua till the following week. So we jump 1 week ahead. This happens in two different situations in Chutz La'aretz, in the calendar. One during a Shana Peshuta, a 12-month one Adar year, and once it happens also during a Shana Me'uberet, a 13-month year with two Adars. The reason I'm splitting them is because the adjustment that we in Israel make in those two kinds of years is different. If it's a Shana Peshuta, then the double sedras that are expected in Chutz La'aretz, which include after Pesach, Tazria Metzora, and Acharei Kedoshim, and Bahar Bechukotai. Here in Israel, we split Bahar and Bechukotai to slow us down, so that by Bamidbar, we're all reading the same thing. Interesting also, in those years, while we are reading Parshat Shmini in Chutz La'aretz, they are celebrating Shmini Shel Pesach. So it's a cute kind of this and that. In a Shana Me'uberet, there are no doubles to split, and we have to go all the way till Matot Maaseh till we find a double to split here in Israel. And in Chutz La'aretz, in those kind of years, it's combined. When it comes to Shavuot on Friday in Israel, Friday Shabbos in Chutz La'aretz, that's the third situation. And there we go out of sync when we read Parshat Noso on the Shabbat right after Shavuot. In Chutz La'aretz, it's the 2nd day of Yom Tov, Torah reading, just like the one from the 8th day of Pesach, almost. And we go one sedra ahead, and it goes until Chukat Balak, which is the original built-in double. Chutz La'aretz follows that. We split Chukat and Balak. We never combine Chukat and Balak. When it comes to Bahar Bechukotai or Matot Maaseh, there are situations where even in Chutz La'aretz, they're separate or combined. But it works out that with Chukat and Balak, it's only combined when Shavuot is Friday, Shabbos, and Chutz La'aretz, and it's always separated by us, including when Shavuot is Friday, and we split that which otherwise would have been combined. If you follow that, that's the story. But Obviously, it's a matter of which way you look at it because it accomplishes the same thing. But in order to explain why we wait all the way till Matot Masei in those years, rather than Chutz La'aretz doubling up Baharin B'chukotai, let's say, they don't double it up because it's not scheduled to be doubled up. The only double coming up after Pesach and Hashanah Me'uberet is Matot Maaseh, which is what we separate. Okay, comments, questions? Let's.
When were Haftaros set up?
As I
You
like
said.
to say, what am I, Rabbi Wein? He would be able to answer that question with a snap of a finger. I would have to look it up. I don't remember exactly, sometime during the Middle Ages when either the Catholic Church or and or other people who of other religions who had shlita over Jews banned Torah reading. It's interesting, they permitted davening, but they banned Torah reading. And to compensate, a haftorah was chosen from the Navi, which they didn't ban. I never understood that either. And it was usually with a theme similar to that of the Sedra, which we weren't allowed to read. This week is a good example of that. You have Parshat Balak, and am I mixing it up with, think I'm mixing it up with Chukat. Yeah, so let's skip that. Let me just check what the Haftorah is, because that will be the same all over the world. No. Anyway, there's very often, most often, some reference in the Haftorah that matches with the Sedra. And then Mefarshim try to say, ah, but it's even more connected because of this and that and whatever. Neil Winkler loves to take a look at the Haftorah, what came before it in the Navi, or what follows it in the Navi, and make additional correct connections, which are very often very interesting. Okay, so I don't know exactly when, but you could look it up either in a real.
I was just wondering because of the 3-year cycle, if they had Haftorahs back then already.
Yeah, that's a good question. My guess is maybe not.
Sounds like it's late. You said Middle Ages, so it could be
Yeah.
later.
Okay, now I also, just as a little point, why would Chutz La'aretz in this kind of year when Shavuot was Friday, why would they double up Dafka, Chukat, and Balak? Why not earlier? If they could have doubled up Naso and Bahalotcha, or whatever. That would be very, very long, so maybe they wouldn't do it because of that. But I did see in a sefer by the Avudraham that they used to double up Shlach and Korach. And for some reason, later it became Chukat and Balak. In any event, Chukat and Balak are very noticeably different, except the common denominator, which maybe is why they were combined, is the issue of Moav being in Chukat, one of the countries, city-states, that we requested permission to pass through their territory in the Midbar, and they refused. And God said, you cannot go to war with them, so go around them. And then we ended up in Chukat conquering territory that Emori had conquered from Moab, which took off the ban from us from conquering it. Let me make that clear. There were two nations that God said, leave them alone, don't fight them, ask if you could pass through their territory, and if they say no, go a different way. They were Edom, which came from Esav, and Moab, which came from Lot. So, in other words, those two were the family countries. And God said, look, giving plenty to Bnei Israel, but I also gave territory to Edom. and to Moab, and you can't take it from them. But then Moab was conquered by Emori, and the ban on taking over that territory was lifted, so to speak, and we ended up capturing it in the end of Hukat. Now, the beginning of Balak begins with Balak Melech Moav at that time, and exactly when we're talking about, it's certainly towards the end of the 40 years in the Midbar, but exactly when and what came first, I'm not sure, and we don't really know that. And Moab said whatever they had left. No way that we could beat Israel, the Israelites, if Og and Sihon, two much mightier kings than us, were defeated by Israel. We don't stand a chance. So I have this picture in my mind of Balak doing some research. Maybe it was only with Google, but maybe later he was able to use ChatGPT or something like that, and found that the power of words, both blessings and curses, are very strong, even stronger than the sword. I find it interesting also that the English word sword is spelled S word. And words is word S. In other words, just take the S from the beginning to the end. And it's a cute way of remembering that our power is the power of speech, tefillah, limud Torah, and acts of chesed with the mouth, etc., etc. And the non-Jewish world relies more on the sword. So here, Balak said, I got a great idea. Let's use their weapon against them. And it was a terrible failure, which we'll get to in a moment. I also want to mention the following, which really belongs to Chukat. Parah Aduma, Chukat, did not happen sequentially where it is in the Torah. In fact, most of our sources agree that Parah Aduma was commanded before Matan Torah in Rephidim, where in Rephidim, where preview of different kinds of mitzvot were given to Bnei Israel, including traditionally Shabbat and Kibbutz Av Ha'Em and Parah Aduma. So it definitely didn't happen in the place in Bamidbar where it's written. In fact, immediately before the presentation of Parah Aduma in last week's Sedra, in Chutz La'aretz, this week's first of two Sedras, immediately before that is Chet HaMeraglim and the rebellion of Korach, which happened at the beginning of the sojourn in the Midbar, in the early, maybe the beginning of the second year out of Mitzrayim, when immediately after, in Chukat, after Parah Aduma, you have the death of Miriam, which definitely happened in the last year of the wandering, the beginning of that last year. And that was followed by Moshe striking the rock and water coming out, and he should have spoken to it, and his punishment, and Aharon's punishment, and then the death of Aharon, and then the battle against Canaan and a contingent of Amalek and Emori and Sihon. All of that happened at the end of the 40 years in the Midbar. So I don't know why Dafka Parah Aduma should be the one that divides between the beginning and the end of the Midbar. It also leaves the question of what happened in between. What happened in year 27 out of Mitzrayim? We have no idea. And more than that, it has nothing to do with us. Whatever happened, happened. Life in the Midbar had been going on and continued to go on. They spent a lot of time in one location. And the Torah doesn't dwell on that. It tells us about events at the beginning and events at the end because they impact on us and we have to learn them. Which brings me to Parshat Balak in the following way. You know that the Torah scroll is divided into books, Bereshit, four blank lines, then Shemot, four blank lines, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim. That's a major divider. And then Parshiot. Parshiot, not to be confused with Parshat HaShavua, Parshiot are the paragraphs, we'll say, in the Torah. They come in two forms. We've discussed this in the past. Parsha Pitucha and Parsha Situma. There are 647 Parshiot in the Torah. They are considered Halacha L'Moshe MiSinai. We didn't make them up. They were passed down by tradition. The Pesukim are not delineated in the Torah scroll. And there are theories that some Pesukim used to be combined and then they were separated, or they were separate and then we combined them. But Parshiot are Parshiot and they stay the way they are, as Petuchot or Stumot, and that doesn't change. Now, with 647 Parshiot in the Torah, if you do the arithmetic, you find that the average length of a Parsha is 8.5 Psukim, roughly. Now also know that the smallest parshiot in the Torah are lo tirzach, two words, whole parsha, a quarter of a pasuk, lo tinaf, lo tignov, those are all three two-word parshiot within the same pasuk, but they're counted separately. And the extreme at the other end are two whole sedras in Bereshit. I think it's Vayeshev, Vayishlach and Miketz. If I'm not mistaken, maybe it's Vayetze. I'll look it up later, and you could also. Two different sedrot, which are a single parsha alone, 100 plus psukim. That's where the average comes out from two to all of those words and psukim, the average comes out to 8.5 berach. I say this because those are definitely the two longest parshiot in the Torah, and a candidate for the third largest is the first part of Balak. Balak is imbalanced in that it is made up of only two parshiot. The first one is 95 psukim, and the second one is 9 psukim. And not only are they different in size, but they are very seriously different in what they tell us. So let's take a look quickly at the 95 pasuk parsha in Balak. Balak panics because he doesn't want to be fought against by Israel. And he sends messengers to Bilam in Midian. Our sources tell us that Midian and Moab were enemies, but they got together in order to fight against Israel, which is something we need to remember ad hayom hazeh. And the lesson that comes from there is that we have to unite in order to defend ourselves, even though it doesn't mean that we wipe out differences or ignore differences or forgive differences. You start counting Ashkenazi and Sephardi, religious, non-religious, religious Zionists and anti-Zionists, one Hasidic group and another Hasidic group, one yeshiva and another yeshiva, one yeshiva that's split into two, and the two sides don't talk to each other, and they are violent against each other. And the same thing goes for certain Hasidic sects, where the Rebbe died, and a son-in-law and a nephew each claim to be the successor, and they have their followers, and they fight with each other. All of that, and everything else, conservative, reform, whatever you want to, secular, anti, doesn't matter, need to be unified in order to help defend ourselves against our enemies, who unify against us. So that's a lesson that comes from the Balak Bilam situation. So Balak sends messengers to Bilam, and he says, "Stay overnight, and I'll see what God tells me." And God tells him, "Don't go with them, because and you can't curse the people because they are blessed by me." And Balak gets up in the morning, and you could feel, just based on knowing the whole story, feel the reluctance in his sending those guys home, saying, "I can't go because God said I shouldn't." Balak doesn't take that for an answer, and he sends a more prestigious delegation with all kind of sorcery, magic to impress Bilam, and further offer for tremendous wealth if he will just come and curse the people of Israel. Bilam says, "I told you already, I can't do anything that God tells me not to do. But stay overnight and let me see what happens," which is already, you know. So God comes to him and says, "You want to go? Go. But remember, you can't say anything unless I put it in your mouth." And on that basis, Bilam goes. It was an interesting thing the first time, first delegation. God appears to him at night and says, "Who are these people?" As if God doesn't know. And the Mefarshim say God did that on purpose to give Bilam the impression that there are windows in time where God, situations that God doesn't know everything. So he was hoping to use one of those windows to succeed in cursing the people, even though God said not to. Okay. So then he's on the way in the famous episode with the donkey, which you see behind me. It's interesting. You just go on to Google and you put in Bilam and donkey clip art. You do Bilam and donkey regular, you get more real images. I was more interested in cartoony kind of things. And it really would make an interesting study for you to look at a whole bunch of them as to what Bilam comes out looking like. In some of them, he's very villainous in the classic cartoon way that you draw a villain. And here, he's a guy with a head covering and a beard, and but there's the Malach, and the Malachim also vary from art conception to art conception. By the way, the website that I have recommended the last number of years for Torah study in Mishnah and Gemara is Al HaTorah. It is amazing the scope of material that's available there and the friendliness of searching. And what annoyed me most recently there was when instead of clicking for English, you now have to click a button where it says, "Do you want English, French, Spanish, this, that?" And then you have to click English. So because they added more languages in translation, I have to put in another click. It's very annoying. Anyway, so in Al HaTorah, they have a section on biblical art. So they take famous situations like Bilam and his donkey, like Avraham and Yitzchak at the Akedah, like the parting of the sea, and they show classic artwork over the centuries and how they portrayed these things. And it's very interesting to take a look at. It's parparot lechokhmah. It's the side dish of wisdom, as opposed to straight learning Torah with Mefarshim or whatever. Okay, so then after the episode with the donkey, Bilam continues. Balak says, "Hey, what took you so long? You were silly for rejecting me the other day." It's not the other day. You're talking about traveling a distance, in the Midbar. You can't really hop into your helicopter and land a couple of hours later. And Bilam and Balak set to their task of hopefully Bilam being able to curse the Jewish people. And Bilam asks for seven altars to be built and seven bulls and seven rams to be offered as korbanot on them. And the Mefarshim say what he was trying to do was balance out the offerings that the Avot brought, as recorded in the book of Bereshit, from here and there and there and there, somehow a total of seven korbanot. So Bilam can say to God, hey, we also offered seven korbanot, seven pairs of korbanot, and therefore don't let the korbanot of the Avot protect Bnei Israel. Let me do what I want to do. And Bilam goes and comes back and says beautiful things about Israel instead of cursing them, and Balak gets annoyed, and they try it a second time, and Balak is even more annoyed. He says, okay, look, I hired you to curse them. I didn't hire you to bless them, so, don't say anything. And Bilam keeps defending himself by saying, I can't say anything unless God gives me these words. But he keeps trying. And he says, didn't work when I went this way to meditate, so I'm going to go in a different place to meditate. And then the third time, he comes out with beautiful description of Bnei Israel. And Balak has had his, pardon the word, fill of his of Balak of Bilam, and sends him home. Now, important point. These 95 psukim were the ones in the whole Torah from the beginning of Shemot till the end that were not witnessed by us. Everything else, Kriyat Yam Suf, Matan Torah, water coming from a rock, a second time, the Mun, everything that happened in the Midbar was witnessed by millions of Jews, millions of Israelites, whatever you want to call them, men, women, and children. This portion, we were totally oblivious to what was going on a hilltop, because we were down on the bottom of the wilderness, whatever you call it, the floor of the plateau, the plain, and we did not see what was going on up above. The only way we know of the story of Bilam and Balak is because God put it into the Torah. But the people then, even though they had gone through Revelation at Sinai and received the Torah, and Moshe Rabbeinu studied the Torah from God, he did not have a Parshat Balak. There's no mitzvot in Parshat Balak. And when he was taught the mitzvah of Parah Aduma at Har Sinai in the 40 days and 40 nights, he wasn't told that right after the Torah would say that, his sister Miriam would die, and then his brother Aharon would die. That was all part of what happened, which is not recorded in the mitzvah parts of the Torah that God shared with Moshe to share with Bnei Israel. According to our tradition, as expressed by the Rambam, Moshe wrote 13 Sifrei Torah at the end of his life. Miraculous, because you can't really do that normally in a short time. And there's an interesting discussion among Mefarshim whether he wrote the last eight psukim, which speaks of his death, or not. And most conclude that yes, he wrote it, but he didn't know what he was writing, which is a whole other issue. And we did not know, they at the time did not know what was happening with Bilam and Balak. We only found out after we got the Torah, the whole Torah scroll. And so then you have to now take a look at different encounters that we had had till then. We came out of Mitzrayim. We approached Yam Suf. Mountains on both sides, a sea in front of us, and Paro had changed his mind and was pursuing the Israelites with his army. And we panicked. And God says to Moshe, say to them, what are you yelling about? Just do what you're told and watch what I will do. And we were witness, we meaning Dor HaMidbar, were witness to Kriyat Yam Suf, and the destruction of the Egyptians in the sea. And they sang a song because of it, which we still say in davening. So there, God took care of the situation. We observed what happened. Then came, shortly thereafter, an attack by Amalek. And the attack by Amalek, Moshe immediately told Yehoshua to form an army and physically fight against Amalek. At the same time, he, Aharon and Hur, brother and nephew, went up to a hilltop to pray to God for help in this battle against Amalek. And that became the more normal situation for the rest of history, that we don't get saved often by a snap of a finger of God, but we have to put in effort. Today, that effort is called Tzahal, IDF, with the good equipment, with the good anti-missile things and everything else that comes along with it. And we believe, have confidence and faith and trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not only on our side, but that he will help all the way through. Now, it reminds me of a couple of stories. One is that person walking on the beach. I don't remember exactly how it goes. Walking on the beach, and God is walking alongside him. Of course, you can't see God, so you see footprints. So the guy is making his own footprints, and God is making footprints, and then the footprints disappear. And the guy says, God, why did you abandon me? Why aren't you still with me? And he says, I never abandoned you. I am actually carrying you on my shoulders. And that's why you see only one set of footprints. It's something like that. You probably need to find exactly how it went. The other thing that came to my mind, yeah, well, that's related to the idea of Kol HaKavod Tzahal. Look what they did in 67, look what they did in this year and that year and the other war and the other war. You have to be spiritually blind not to see a serious contribution by God in all of this. I don't know if it's 50-50 or 60-40 or 40-60. That's not the issue, but he's there. I mean, the last story on the internet that caught my attention, and I'm sure you all read it because Nurith posted it, and that's a story from a month and a half ago with a drone, an explosive drone from Hezbollah, which got tangled in an Erev wire around an army camp and exploded without harming anybody. Had it not been entangled by this Erev wire, it could have done very serious damage or claimed casualties. So you see something like that and you smile and you say, Baruch Hashem, but don't think that that's the only contribution that God made or is making to this war effort. He is there all the time. We can ponder and even ask. Now here, be careful. When I'm saying ask, there's two ways to ask a question. One is the question could be showing a lack of faith, or the question can be total trust in God. I just would like to know a little bit more about what you're doing. That's different. That's sort of like na'aseh v'nishma. I will do. I will believe. I will trust. But I want to know. And by the way, this goes back to Chukat also. When we say that Paraduma and other things like it are chukim, that defy understanding, and we do them because God commanded them, period, and we can't question them, we always question them. You open up any sefer that deals with Taryag Mitzvot, When you turn the page to Parshat Chukat and you see the portion on Porah Aduma, it does not say we're skipping attempting to give reasons for this because it's a chok. Instead, volumes have been written trying to understand all the elements of Porah Aduma, especially the most enigmatic one of that it is purifying the impure, but at the same time it makes some of the purer people impure. And shatnez. Shatnez is a chok. Why don't we wear garments of wool and linen? Because the Torah forbids it. Period. End of story. No. Make it a semicolon, which is a serious pause, meaning I am committed to not wear shatnez. Pause. Because it's a mitzvah. Pause. Now, can you give me a little hint, a little idea to grab on as to what there is behind the prohibition of shatnez? And there are beautiful things behind it, which I don't think you want me to go into now. But they're there. And the same thing for any chok. Now, the opposite side of this is that every sensible, common sense, logical, reasonable mitzvah, which is called usually a mishpat, which is defined as a behavior that normal good people would come up with on their own, even if they weren't commanded. Take as a contrast now, take men, take leather boxes, perfectly squared off, put portions of the Torah in there, put leather straps around it, and put it on your arm and on your head. Nobody would ever dream that up on his own. Has to be commanded. But you still have a lot of insight as to the significance of it being on the left bicep area, which when you put your hand against your body is right up against your heart, and in the middle of your head at the beginning, which I always like to say, up to your hairline, that is former hairline, not current one, and near the brain, and what comes from that in the discussion. But essentially, tefillin is not something that a person would come up with on his own. Pay for damages that you cause. That's a mitzvah also. No less of a mitzvah than shatnez and tefillin. And yet, that's a mitzvah that we probably, any good society, would come up with on its own. That if you cause damage, you're expected to pay for it. And if the person who you damaged was sharing in the negligence that created the damage, then you split the difference. These are mitzvot that are also in line mostly with common sense and logic. And there are many of those as well. And then you have things in the middle, which, okay, I get the logic and the reason for resting on Shabbat, but not carrying a handkerchief in my pocket, tissues, whatever. I actually, a number of years ago already, showed my granddaughter my handkerchief in my pocket, or she saw me sneeze, pull out my handkerchief and wipe my nose and put it back. And she went, "Ew, you blow your nose and you put it back into your pocket?" She couldn't understand that idea. But I grew up with handkerchiefs, and my father had handkerchiefs, and everybody had handkerchiefs. Okay. So Shabbos, very reasonable day of rest, emulating God. He rested from his creation. We rest from our creative week. But there are elements of Shabbos that defy logic. So there is an element of chok within reasonable, logical kind of mitzvah also. And the balance is sometimes way towards the chok side and sometimes way towards the mishpat side, but it's always some kind of blend of the two. And the corollary of that is that our commitment to Torah and mitzvot, first and foremost, is because of mitzvah. Why, when you saw a person, I've used this example in the past, overloaded with bundles from the supermarket. Why did you go over and say, let me help you with that? Because I'm nice, because it's a nice thing to do, because that person was struggling with these loads and I can help. Beautiful. First, not the only, but first, the mitzvot aseh in the Torah to help a person. That does not take away from being a nice person. There are people who think that it does. Oh, you're just doing it because it's a mitzvah. No, I'm doing it because it's a mitzvah that teaches me how to be a nice person, or that goes along with my being a nice person. And that's part of this also. Of this is a gezeira from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we can't, just train of thought, shechita. There was a book which I have by an Eliyahu monk. I think it was written in the early 1900s about shechita from a religious, halachic, and social. I don't remember the title anymore. But in there, they have actual scientific experiments which indicate that shechita, the way we do it, is the most humane way of killing the animal. It compared it with all other kind of things. Very nice. Then somebody else came up with in the early mid-1900s with all kind of physical benefits from circumcision. And we said, oh, we've been doing it for 3,000 years and you just finally came up in 1947 or 1962 with the benefits of Brit Milah. So there's a problem here with Shechita and with Milah and with any mitzvah. You come up with a very nice pat on the back, Kol HaKavod Judaism, Kol HaKavod Torah and mitzvot, because you're doing it the best way. And then what happens when laser slaughter becomes even more humane than shechita with a knife? Do you change to that? No, because shechita has rules and the rules have to be followed. And to put this as an extreme, there are sources that say, had God commanded us to brutally butcher a cow while it's alive in order to take its meat, we would do it because that would be God's command. We could also say, but he would never do that. And he didn't do that. But it's not because shechita is humane that we do it. It's because God commanded it. And the fact that it's humane is a bonus. I use this example with Tsar Bali Chaim. Who is the main beneficiary of anything that we do to promote kindness to animals? The answer is we, us. The animal's benefit comes second. Yes, it's beneficial to a cat not to grab it by its tail, wave it around your head, and throw it against the wall. Definitely is beneficial to the cat. But the mitzvah that forbids me to do that is for my spiritual growth and moral growth and social growth, and the fact that the animal benefits from it, good. Because there are things related to that where the animal doesn't benefit from it, but we still do. Like covering the blood of shechita after you shecht the chicken. The chicken is beyond caring. We benefit from it because we pause to think of the significance of blood, not just of the chicken, but of all blood of animals that have blood, fowl and mammals. Okay. So that's, to me, the unusual thing about these 95 psukim that we. Oh, so I started to say about, in this case of Bilaam and Balak, it's as if God said, you know what? I'll take care of this one myself. I won't even let them watch. They won't participate. Their participation is living and ethical life, as evidenced by the Mefarshim on Ma Tovu O Halecha Yaakov, Mishkanotecha Yisrael, where the Mefarshim explain that what Bilam witnessed, is that the arrangement of the tents were such that one family did not look directly into another family's tent to preserve its privacy. And he was impressed by that. And it came out in a sentence that is used on synagogue decoration, outside, inside, on the walls and stained glasses throughout history. Matovo Alecha Yaakov. You realize you're quoting Bilam Harasha? No, you're actually quoting HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who put those words into Bilam and didn't let him say anything else. So it's there. Now, as I find it almost humorous or farcical to read these 95 psukim as to what happened with these giants of the spiritual world, because Mefarshim say that Balak was a greater prophet than Bilam. Bilam's specialty was cursing, so that's why he hired him, but he had Nevuah also. I don't know what that means exactly. But these, let's call them spiritual giants, and they couldn't get their act together. Every single time they tried something else, they could not succeed until they realized how to defeat us. And that is make us do something that will get God angry enough to punish us. And those last nine psukim in the parsha are exactly that. Right after Bilam and Balak part ways, to the point where the Midrashim and Mefarshim have to say, before they parted, they gave the advice to each other of let's get our women involved in seducing the men for worship of Baal Peor, which is what happened. Nine psukim, which continue next week in the beginning of Parshat Pinchas. But these nine psukim say that we started, Israelite men were seduced by Moabite women to, I'm adding the word, the orgiastic worship of Baal Peor. And God decreed that they should be killed, the worshipers. And everybody froze except for Pinchas, who is labeled a zealot. And zealotry is something that you have to see as do not try this on your own. Even though there's an expression, kana'im pogimbo, a zealous person can circumvent the legal process of law. We'll talk more about that on Wednesday. Pinchas did what he did, and we don't know until the beginning of next week, etc., that he was actually greatly rewarded for that from God. But he was challenged, very seriously challenged, mostly by the people of Shevet Shimon, whose leader was Zimri, who Pinchas killed. To be continued. Comments, questions. Tirza. No, we can't read lips, Tirza.
Okay. A few years ago, my husband and I went for blood tests here in Israel, and the most secular looking nurse says to my husband, I'm not going to do it on your left hand because you need your hand tomorrow for your tefillin. And she did on his right hand. I mean, I you never would have picked her out as someone. I didn't even know she was Jewish.
I've told this story before, but the first morning, 5 o'clock in the morning in basic training on Shlav Bet when I started, the Mefaked finished his briefing and he said, Datiyim to Beit HaKnesset, Chilonim, come with me. During the day, a Sephardi Jew, not religious as we would call it, came up to me. I was the oldest in the group. Our group was from age 30 to 37. I was 37, and they called me Dode. I was the uncle of the group and its spokesman to the commanders. He said to me, he called me a Chiloni. I'm not a Chiloni. Chas v'chalila, I'm not a Chiloni. I'm not dati, but. So I went to the commander and I whispered to him. And the next morning, 5 o'clock, he finished his briefing and said, Eile shemit palalim b'veit ha-knesset l'beit ha-knesset. Eile shalom mit palalim b'veit ha-knesset, come with me. And that set the tone for the whole time. We didn't have any, it's us versus them. We had 9 religious guys out of 23 in my kita. Never had a problem with a minyan because there was always, sadly to say, just a Sephardi willing to join, or many Sephardim willing to join. The non-religious Ashkenazis sort of ran the other way. But we always had a minyan, and we had even a short Dvar Torah while we were taking off our tefillin. We didn't want to extend the time. We actually, the army requires you be given a certain amount of time for each davening. And I went in one of my meetings representing the group to the Mempeh, and I said, 25 minutes is not enough. He said, how much do you need? I said, we could do it in 30. He gave us 30 minutes. So there'll always be cooperation because Kulanu Yehudim, or as you said, we don't
I'll pull
even
you
know if she
back.
was Jewish. I also had one guy in the Machlakah whose father was a diplomat and he was in the army anyway. But generally, if religious Jews behave respectfully with non-religious Jews, the non-religious Jews will come around and behave properly also.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you.